Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 15th of September 2018, Episode 2. Just going to flip back because there's a page I missed going through here, and I'm going to really push myself and write a blog about what I've written. How's that for memory work? Just to get things up and going. Okay, this one is by Frank Swain, Sheep Culture Seen in Migration Routes. So, basically a culture is something given, a memory, a stored memory of society, the parent, to something to the child that its parent has taught, like the grandparent, so the information goes through. And this is the big thing, it is behaviour, alert behaviour. And I think the big sort of aha moment of alert behaviour is when the big tits, I think, or blue tits, and I think they were big tits, of Britain began to peck their way through all their milk supplies. I said, look, this has to be sucked, you know. No, and they also observed monkeys learning from each other to go through, and the fact that you can train animals in the lab. Okay, some sheep have a cultural tradition of migrating, but this knowledge can be lost in generation if their journeys are interrupted. Every spring, bighorn sheep, and look, there's pictures of these sheep, and they've got big horns, migrate to high altitudes following nutritious new vegetation as it emerges from the melting snow. This behaviour is known as surfing the green wave. But is the knowledge of these routes inherited or genetically? Or must it be learned? To answer this question, Brett Jemster at the University of Wyoming and his colleagues looked at how these sheep behave when moved to a new location by people, known as translocation. They studied data from 129 bighorn sheep and four populations that had lived in the same area for more than 200 years. From four populations, so each population would probably have 32 in a bit. The animals were fitted with GPS collars, as you do, and the team compared their movements with those 80 sheep translocated into new populations in unfamiliar environments. Okay, it's a bit unclear exactly how those sheep were put in. Between 65 and 100% of the sheep living in the same area as their ancestors climbed 1,000 metres up the mountainside to graze on new vegetation as it appeared in the spring. By contrast, only 7 of the translocated sheep behaved in this way. So this is one of the 8 sheep, is that right? Oh no. Okay, so there's, what is it? There's, 73 left behind. Oh, because the other 73 translocated sheep didn't migrate. It seems that migration clues aren't hardwired into the animal's genetics. Oh, you have to say, you know, it could be a little bit. It's just, this suggests that knowledge about migration routes is learned from the transfer to other members of the herd, including the youngsters who will make up the next generation. Biologists call this culture and the transfer cultural transmission. What about the other 7 sheep? What about you? You're statistically insignificant. Can I say, for me, they were testing me and they said, oh, you're totally out of range of the norm. We're just not going to include you in our data. Thanks very much for that. The researchers suspected the cultural knowledge becomes more sophisticated as the generations pass. To support the idea, they looked at the data from 169 tagged mooses. One would hope that they would actually put the GPS's, be able to put it up. So they've got heaps of GPS's because there's only 129 bighorn sheep. Those that migrated the furthest belonged to populations that had been established in the same regions for 110 years. Migration distance was lower than the moose who had lived in the area for just 10 years. If migrations are cut off, within a few generations, centuries of knowledge are lost, says Jessner. One is difficult to understand. It's easy to fool a hate speech detector. There's something a bit Cosmic about this, again by Frank Swain. Your whole page to you, Frank. A few innocuous words or spelling errors are enough to trip up the software designed to flag hate speech. The finding casts doubt on the use of technology to tame the online discourse. Social media sites are under increasing pressure to act on abusive accounts and content. Recently, Twitter and YouTube, Facebook and Apple removed high-profile conspiracy theorists Alex Jones from their platforms, citing hate speech and bullying. But tackling the millions of anonymous accounts used to post abuse online is much more difficult. In Oskin of Aalto University in Finland, his colleagues investigated 7 different systems used to identify offensive texts. This included a tool built to detoxify arguments in Wikipedia's edit section, another called Perspective, and several other systems. I must be surfing the wrong part of Wikipedia because it seems all very mellow to me. Offensive speech filters typically flag contents using either a predefined list of offensive words, like fuck off, or artificial intelligence trained algorithms that have been trained on thousands of examples. These systems tested had each been built by different teams, so had been trained on different data sets of offensive innocuous materials. Asking, how do you know? It's just bizarre. Surely you pick the most obvious stuff to get them going. Alison found that none of the filters performed well when set to work on data sets belonging to a different system. This suggests that the filters would struggle when applied to a real world in a forum or a social network. In addition, the team tested different techniques for bypassing the filters. All the systems failed to identify offensive speech when spelling errors were introduced, or when numbers were substituted as letters, such as new scientists. I like that. They also found, this is the 3 for the E and new, and 5 for scientists. It's easiest. Looks 5 is almost impossible to do. You'd think you'd be able to trick that one, to get that one sorted out. They also found that adding innocuous words increased the likelihood of offensive content would bypass the filters. Some words were particularly effective at masking hateful content because they're strong positive connotations. It says Alex, for example, a sentence that Perspective assigned a toxicity of 0.99, with 1 being peak acidity, could be reduced to 1.5 by simply adding the word love. Some keyword filters are complex AI that were equally vulnerable to these workarounds. Perspective, which is created by Google's counter-abuse team at Jigsaw, a subsidiary of Google's parent company, Alphabet, has recently been updated to try to deal with some of these issues. Quote, "We welcome people to scrutinize the technology," says Dan Kayserling at Jigsaw. He says Perspective shouldn't be used to automatically block content, but should be instead provide information for people who may or may not intervene. The major problem is there is little agreement amongst the building of filters and societies in general on what constitutes hate speech, says Tommy Gonehowl, who has worked on the latest study. She hasn't... Look, I just have to say, I'm not that sure that they have actually told me what the latest study is, have they? Well, assume that study they're talking about is the latest. Okay, so that's unfortunately several pages back. And now we're on to a main article. That's actually a fair number of pages back. Sorry about missing that one. And so I'm going to really test my memory by writing up about this Frank Swain again. Good on you, Frank Swain. Invasion of the face snatchers. Face recognition has rapidly wormed its way into everything from policing to shopping. Is it too late to hold back the tide? Frank Swain reports. I'm just trying to think what he'll say. Yes, but it's not that bad. Well, I don't know. That's what they probably say. What, you know, we want to predict. Really interesting to see what, how you read things and how to predict it. Last December, Ed Bridges was mingling in the crowds of Christmas shoppers at the streets of Cardiff, UK, when police snapped a picture of him. Okay, what I want to say is, Cardiff, what a metropolis. He was trying, we've been there backpacking in 90, so it may have upmarketed, but just, it was a nice little homely country town. He's been trying to get them to delete it ever since. Bridges hasn't been convicted of a crime, nor is he a suspect of committing one. However, his name is now posted all over New Scientist. He's simply one of a vast number of people who have been quietly added to face recognition database without their consent, and most often without their knowledge. Well, okay, yeah, I'll allow that. For years, critics have warned that technology is an unparalleled invasion of privacy, but the rise of face recognition seems unstoppable. Police forces across the world have launched face recognition programs, setting up cameras to scan crowds at football matches, festivals, protests, and busy streets in a bid to identify criminal suspects. The tech giants are also in on the game. Facebook relies on recognition to automatically take photos. Snapchat uses it to overlay fun animations on your face. Latest iPhone ditched fingerprint scanners and famous of using face recognition to unlock devices. It's sort of like a password. I don't know where I'm that upset about iPhone. Amazon's recognition, K-O-G-N-I-T, image analysis software, promises, amongst other things, that it can spot faces from a library of suspects for law enforcement. Okay, well, it's not very commercial. You know, I want pizza here. The police deliver it to him. It is surprising just how far this tech reaches. US airline JetBlue is trialling it to speed up boarding. If you imagine that. Visitors at Madison Square Garden in New York are scanned on entry to see if they might pose a problem to organizers. Jaywalkers in Shenzhen, China, risk being fined for having their mugshot taken by cameras placed at pedestrian crossings. It seems nobody can escape. Now, I must admit, I was in China and rode on their flying pigeon bikes, and I was like this huge elephant, and everyone was, and the people behind me said, "Don't look back, just don't look back." So China's a pretty mad thing. I mean, there's lots of them around. Yet around the world, face databases are running into problems. Oh no, not problems. Oh no, oh gosh, everything's good, but no, a problem. India's Supreme Court is due to rule on whether its national ID scheme called Aadhaar, Aadhaar, breaches citizens' privacy. I think it might. The system, which includes mandatory enrollment in a face recognition program, contains the details of 1.2 billion citizens and has suffered huge leaks of sensitive data. A government leak, sort like that. In the US, an audit of FBI in 2016 found that it had built up a database of more than 400 million face images. Well, that's more than the US population, bucko. That's 380 million, 85? I don't know. Faces images, including half the US adult population, without proper oversight. Well, that's just bizarre. So, I mean, some of them must be, therefore, a good, more than 50% must be foreigners. Suspect criminals make up less than 10% of the library. What? 40 million criminals? Oh my godfather. Meanwhile, China is using face recognition technology to monitor discrimination against the Muslim population in the northwest province of Xinjiang. As well as scanning people's faces before they enter markets to buy fuel, the system alerts authorities if the target individuals stray more than 300 metres beyond their home or workplace, effectively building virtual checkpoints to hem him in the Uyghur Muslims. Ah, oh, bloody hell. Sorry. Look, I have to apologise to the human race for what they're doing. That's outrageous. Such discrimination aside, you might feel reassured about having your face stored on a database if it helps solve a crime. As me, yep. However, despite its popularity with law enforcement, face recognition is often inaccurate. See the graphic derived to the right. Okay. Figures released by the South Wales Police show that when the technology was deployed at a music festival in Swansea in May, 12 people were flagged by the cameras as a match to the police databases. But only 2 matches were correct because they were trying to do KISS. You know the band KISS? The clowns. Still, the American Civil Liberties Union recently demonstrated how Amazon's recognition erroneously identified members of Congress in the database of unrelated mugshots. It's now calling for a moratorium on the use of the technology by law enforcement. Quote, the worry is that text will spread and start to be used before we've had the debate about whether it should be used at all. You know what I really feel? That's how a majority of people do management anyway. They sort of do a feign for it. The worry is the tech, so this is very imperfect technology going into institutions that are themselves imperfect, and that would be my fundamental thing, that the institutions are rooted. That combination makes problems which should not be swept underneath the rug. Critics swarm that innocent people are being put at risk by software that is wrongly identified as criminals. Well, yeah, I must admit, that's okay, but I think there's a bigger thing of flawed technologies with flawed idiots running it. In very simple terms, tech is outpacing legislation. It's sort of like this paragraph really doesn't develop the last one. This is Paul Wills of the UK Biometrics Commission, who's charged with overseeing the government's use and retention of DNA fingerprints. In the UK, these biometrics were restricted by law passed in 2012, but there's no such restriction on technology such as face recognition, voice recognition and iris scanning, which have taken off since then. Quote, there's been a significant development of biometrics as part of a bigger development of the capacity and store and use data, says Wills. My comment is that would you trust the government which has sent you off to war in Iraq? And they'd say, well, okay, you've stuffed that up. Now, come on, let's do the next thing. You tell us to swap the memory. Okay. After being photographed in the Cardiff, Bridges was snapped again in March when he was joined a protest against the arms fair being held in the city. Quote, at lunchtime, this face recognition van suddenly appeared across the road from the main group of protesters, he said. I felt I was done to intimidate us so we would not use our right to peacefully protest. And this is actually quite subtle, isn't it? The fact that you've got morons. I think we should just ban morons. Protesters, activists will think twice if they know they speak out about government abuse, they're going to be recognised, said Gulani. May as well just give up and just protest. Everyone has to protest as part of work experience. There are real concerns that face recognition will contribute to surveillance structure where people don't feel they can walk around with anonymity and privacy. Yeah, it's a little hard to understand that. If you're in a big city, it matters. Out here, where there's just no one, you walk around the street, there's no one. Bridges is now taking legal action to challenge the use of face recognition technology by South Wales Police. Assisting him is Megan Golding, a lawyer, that's as well, at the human rights group called Liberty. That's even better. Quote, part of the reason we're challenging the use of face recognition at all is we think it's pretty impossible to protect yourself, she says, because the indiscriminate nature of technology, it can happen without your knowledge or consent. Liberty, which is the group, not her, is pushing for a judicial review, a legal mechanism that allows individuals to challenge the actions of public bodies. Golding hopes that a legal case would rule that the way face recognition is being used breaches human rights and data protection laws, leading to halt its use. I must admit that when I was in Budapest and Moscow, these people would jump out from behind bushes and snap you with telephoto lenses. The old style. So, I think I might have been snapped there. And I said, why? Oh, this person jumped out and photographed me. I don't understand what it was all about. Face the future. If South Wales police are found to have acted unlawfully, it will prevent other police forces using technology in the same way. Gordon expects a ruling early next year, but Wills is cautious about relying on a single decision. Quote, I think the danger is the government responds on an ad hoc basis, face recognition today, voice recognition tomorrow, and so on. What she'll be doing is setting out a strategy for police in general. I just think, you know, at the end of the day, there's going to be so many parameters, you know, big data, Internet of Things, CCTV footage, everything. Like the Russians. Why do we think the Russians did it? Why do we think they're from Russians? Well, they boarded, this is the people who did the Novichok stuff. They boarded an Aeroflot flight, which is uniquely Russian. Flew out from Russia, landed in the UK, went to Salisbury, killed someone, went back again, and out again. That's sort of a joke. Such trials, we should, okay. I think we need to do trials to protect privacy, but allow development, says Wilts. This should be peer-reviewed, published, all the usual things you'd expect of a medical trial. Such trials will demonstrate the reliability and limitations of software, such as whether it is less accurate when matching people from minority groups. Only then a sensible public debate about the technology can take place. I do have some logical points I'd like to point out. Wills points out the approach of the Scottish Government in July published a document that recommends general principles for use and retention of biometric data. A commissioner can then draw up codes of practice for each application so that different rules can apply for matching faces of people who have been arrested to mugshots compared with automatically scanning the faces of crowds. Quote, it's a clever solution that seems to an insoluble problem. So, yeah, I don't quite understand that. However, this is a compromise too far for Golding. Quote, in our view, we don't think it's possible to balance the existence of this technology. The impact of rights is too grave. What I think is that we're using the technology as a for law enforcement, also for selling things. But I think that if you can see someone and see their gait change, you can pick up whether they're sick. Sort of like a health monitoring of the population. I'd be interested in if you could do that particular thing, whether you could health monitor people, sort of some benign good things, so you can see if there's depression, you know, people are depressed, they're a bit more stooped. I don't know. I think if you're going to gather data, you have the obligation to use that data for the maximum good of the person. That's my opinion. I don't know how it works. A bubble set to burst. A decade after the financial crash, theory says the surge of populism that followed it should end. Willett, says Simon Oxham. So the stock market crash was in 1932, 1933, and then we had World War II going by then. Okay, but we'll see what they say here. On 15th of September 2008, investment bank Lehman Brothers collapsed, precipitating a global financial crash. In years that followed, politics took an apparently unexpected turn. We saw Brexit, the election of Donald Trump, and the rise of the far-right movement in Europe after decades of steadily increasing social libertarianism. Sweden is just the latest example. Many are now wondering if this is a new norm. In 20, 15, Manuel Frank of the Free University of Berlin and his colleagues turned to data analysis for the answer. Of course, no one's going to listen to you if you think I've turned to my bank of opinion. They found over the past 140 years, every major financial crisis has followed by the surge of support of far-right movements. But I don't know if anyone happened in Berlin, of course. The good news for liberalism is it faded after 10 years after bombing campaigns. Well, it can't be true. Okay. If Spatton holds once more, we should be on schedule to see the surge of populism petering out. What is interesting is that if you look at World War II, it's based on World War I, and World War I is based on other things. Funk and his colleagues wrote, quote, after a crisis, voters seem particularly attracted to the political rhetoric of extreme right, which often attributes blame to minorities or foreigners. Voters of far-right parties increase strongly. Government majorities shrink. Fractionalization of parliaments rises. The overall number of parties represented in parliament jumps. Although some political after-effects are measurable for a decade, the political upheaval is mostly temporary, they add. Funk's work is rooted in data analysis. Grounded data analysis. Finding evidence for the apparent link between political trends and financial crisis, but not deeper behavioural reasons behind that link. I offer no hypothesis. I've forgotten the word. Oh, help. I something rather know. I feign no hypothesis. However, other studies already suggest reasons why. In times of turmoil, support rises for protectionist policies favoured by far-right populist movements, be they on immigration, unfair trade, or security. These studies point to negatively bias, a common trait in which people subconsciously respond more and pay more attention to negative than positive events. After taking into account social economic factors, those who are more biologically responsive to and devote more attention to negative events tend to favour protective policies. So after the deep economic shock, the threat to the livelihoods and national prosperity that follows, protective policies, politics may simply find a more receptive audience. If Funk's cycles hold, the appeal of such politics fades again and economic recovery takes hold, which is the case now. Oh. I suppose it is true. It's not all political scientists agree. Oh, well, these cycles will apply now. Justin Murphy of the University of Southampton, UK, expects the pendulum to continue to swing further in the opposite direction this time. To him, the root cause of identity rise of populist right may be linked to a backlash against social liberals overstating the extent to which freedom of thought and or behaviour has been restricted. Despite declines in racism and sexism in the US and UK in recent decades, there is clearly a case being made, at least, that some overzealous elements among the left are harming their own cause by, and maybe sparking a backlash at the ballot box. Now that's interesting. This is demonstrated in an incident early this year when renowned liberal psychologist Stephen Pinker outlined his thoughts on how to deconstruct the fight back against false and illogical racist sexist claim made by alt-right activists. When a cut-down clip appeared on YouTube, Pinker was branded as a racist for daring to be and the darling of the alt-right in a blow-up that saw left-wing activists up in arms against one another. It's hard to deny that the divided left combined with self-destructive radical elements isn't at least somewhat responsible for the rise of the far right. Okay, well, it's also like an equation, isn't it? A larger factor, however, may be ironically the decline in voting. Simon Hooks of the London School of Economics has charted the combined votes for all political parties across Europe for the past century and points to a sharp and steady rise of non-voting over the past three decades. Non-voters were a minority in the pre- and post-war years, but now they form the single largest bloc of the electorate, dwarfing the far-right groups and the impact of the divided left. As a result, small shifts in support for... Okay, so we're actually just... people giving up on democracy and populism that translate to outsized effects and election results. Yet, in Australia, everyone has to vote. It's not legal stuff. You have... not military service, but you've got to do jury duty and vote. If the state says you have to go in a jury, you have to go in a jury. And if you... and it says you have to vote. If apathetic voters are tempted back to the polling booth, that might herald the return of a more familiar political landscape. However, it's also possible the trend of increasing apathy will continue to grow, fueled by the knock-on effects of the rise of social media. Social media may be leading the replacement effect, where people feel so satisfied expressing their feelings online that they don't vote. It could also be changing the way we think about democracy in other ways, enabling filter bubbles, creating echo chambers to allow the emergence of micro-target political messaging to sort that set the deadlines of late. Anyone hoping for an easy answer to the question of what happens next will probably be disappointed. Political and behavioural scientists is messy and exists in a rapidly changing world where the narratives of the past may longer apply. No. That's insane. Narratives of the past are not applying to the future. What's going on? So many new factors that play that future elections are likely to continue to be more unpredictable than before. And I think that may actually be it, that one of the things is the predictability of elections are becoming less predictable. With all this in mind, it would be brave pundit that stake their reputation on Funke's 10-year rule predict the bursting of the populist bubble. The first test may be the US midterms, but they are typically a show of electoral punishment for the incumbent. So the Funke, who suggests the outcome in November will be more a reflection of Trump's recent performance than any kind of bellwether for broader effects. So it might take a presidential election in the US to really tell what's going on, which means you may have to wait for another few years to see if political shakeup that followed 2008 crisis is over. That is if the next crash isn't on us by then. And of course one has to say, I think there's a lot of centuries in the last two millennia which the French Revolution didn't happen. I think the French Revolution is pretty amazing. Okay, now here's an ISIS. Oh dear. So it's in space, no one could hear you drill, and they're showing you this little hole, and it just looks like a hole drilled in. Oh my god, that's obvious. Let's see. Someone's drilled a hole somewhere. It says, tiny hole would have leaked away all the air in the ISIS in 18 days, and they found it, little bastards. Lee Kane. There was a minor panic in low Earth orbit recently when flight controllers for the International Space Station noticed that it was slowly leaking air into space. Six astronauts on board were instructed to put aside all their work and trace the leak. So you can imagine that would be a relatively easy thing. You'd shut a door and see which the pressure gun. They found a 2 millimeter wide hole. Now that's an incredibly fast hole, because I've had, you couldn't pump down a vacuum system there. Okay, that's a fair amount of air. And the Soyuz capsule docked and sealed up. Some are now saying that the hole could have been deliberate sabotage, but it looks like sabotage to me. Roscosmos, a Russian space agency, set up a special commission to investigate the leak. Trust you Russians, they're probably doping themselves stupid. At first it seemed the most likely explanation was that the unfortunate encounter was a tiny meteorite. But the mystery deepened on close inspection. You can imagine a meteorite would just completely wreck the station. I'd just be nervous up there the whole time. It's strange that a lot of people actually don't know what this International Space Station is. The average punter does not know that there is an orbit, this big orbiting space station. It's a bit of a waste. But the mystery deepened on closer inspection. The hole seems to have come from inside the station. It looks striking, like it's been made by a powder. It looks as though I would have made it like a powder. You can actually see it. There's little bits where it gets... This is done by human hand. Right, well, you hope there's no Wookiee in there. There's no Wookiee or some other thing. Okay. Unless you've got a monkey in there with a powder. There are traces of the drill sliding along the surface. This is what's going on. Dmitry Rogozin told a Russian news agency. He said the special commission will continue to investigate and find out who drilled the hole and whether it was an accident. You know what? If you find someone who thinks, oh, me. Accident in Russian. But we have already ruled out a meteorite version. What could be a meteorite hole? We're checking the Earth version, but there's another version that we do not rule out. Deliberate interference in space. Oh, God. What? Why is this Russian person saying that? Maxim Zakharov, a Russian politician and former cosmonaut, speculated that a member of the ISS crew who wanted to return to the Earth may have drilled the hole. Oh, I don't know why he didn't actually making so he could get some Novichok. We're all humans, and anyone might want to go home, but the method's really low. Told the Russian news agency Novice. If a cosmonaut pulled this strange stunt, and that can't be ruled out, it's really bad. But the simplest explanation is that it was a manufacturing mistake that nobody caught until it started to make trouble. I can't believe no one not taking that. And it's sort of amazing that you wouldn't catch it anyway. To me, speculation and sabotage sound like a desperate stretch of avoiding implicating the space program and workmanship. But however, I just can't see a spacecraft. There's just no way that would get up. Says Jonathan McDowell of Harvard's Center for Astrophysics. It feeds into a more general impression of quality control. The Russian space program is poor. This has just got sabotage written all over it somewhere. In particular, the mechanical failures of several Russian proton rockets since 2007 has raised concern that the program's quality control measures aren't stringent enough. In the US, any concerns about safety of aircraft or spacecraft can be reported anonymously, reducing incentives to keep a mistake quiet, as if there's any such thing as anonymous in USSR. That's not so in Russia, which might encourage workers to slap some glue over the hole and say nothing to avoid being fired, says McDonald. Now, there's a similar thing with the Hubble Space Telescope. The US-Russia relations is already strained by the political situation on the ground. At the moment, NASA is unable to fly astronauts to space and instead rely on Russian vehicles. But that deal expires next year. NASA plans a private spacecraft made by SpaceX and Boeing to pick up the slack. I think it's the political level. It will accelerate the desire to get the commercial crews going and get us off the dependency on Russian vehicles. This is McDonald's. If it can happen once, it can happen again, or maybe in more vital space. Now, I just don't think well enough into conspiracy theories. Now, here's a beautiful set of old chaps sitting around looking at space. Look at that. Couple of old guys in the living rooms and star charts and looking out for the old. I must admit, we had an old observatory in just outside our place. A real horrible. It's a real tragedy that we can't have a stargazing out here more easily. Nestled behind the Chichero Mountains, about 400 kilometres from the city of Phoenix, is a village that attracts astronomers, amateur stargazers and photographers from around the world. They are drawn there by the spectacular night sky, which can be seen thanks to the village's no outdoor light rule. Jack Newton, middle right, came up with the idea for a purpose-built community of starter lovers in 2001 and co-founded the 450-acre Arizona Sky Village. Photographer Fabian Swiss spent a week in the village in last November, showing up every night on the doorstep of several residents, including Jim Lamb, pointing to a star map. This is like a retirement village for astronomers. It's pretty amazing. And bottom left, Esmet retired from NASA astrophysics and was one of the village's first residents. Specialized stargazers gadgets are common in the village. Esmet's home, shown in the neighboring picture, has two domed observatories, a variety of telescopes. Resident Jack Burnhoe is one of the biggest telescope domes there. He hosts visiting school trips and teaches classes about the sky and stars. Beautiful. It was an interesting experience, Weiss says, because the normal rhythm was totally shifted. Not much to do in daylight and endless hours at night. Besides Nebula's galaxies and Milky Way, top left, Weiss saw shooting stars through his binoculars. It's one of the most memorable memories of the trip, he says. All of a sudden, the other planets felt so close, and it felt much more part of the universe than before. Can I say, that's where I really get the most out of astrophysics. You look up the sky at night, and it seems a bit 3D. I don't know why it feels 3D. You just know the distances, different things, and it just looks 3D. It looks, I can't describe it. But it's the feeling of studying gives you that 3D feel for it. I want to make a chemical brain. Wanker. Oh, God. I don't know who this person is, but he looks like a complete tosser. But, no, he's probably a great person. Chemist Lee Cronin's ambition to understand his life, the deepest questions is matched by the unorthodoxy of his methods. Ron Hooper discovers... When Lee Cronin was 9, he was given a Sinclair ZX81 computer and a chemistry set. Unlike most children, Cronin imagined how great it would be if the two things could be combined to make a programmable chemical computer. Like Seinfeld, what's the deal with this? What's the deal with chemical computers? Now 45 and the rich chair of chemistry at the University of Glasgow, Cronin leads a research team of more than 50 people. But his childhood obsession remained. He is constructing chemical brains, and his ambition to create artificial life is using a radical new approach. He's sort of like a funding magnet. You wouldn't be able to stop him. What drives you? Everything I'm doing now, I've wanted to do since I was a boy. I wanted to discover something new about the universe. It was stressful for my parents because anything that they bought, I just took apart. Once I tried to build a carbon dioxide laser. When I was 7 or 8, I ripped the logic unit out of the washing machine and cathode tube from the TV and tried to connect it all up to make my first computer. So I'll just reflect on that. 7 or 8. I think it sort of goes back to why they get him a Sinclair computer, but I don't know, he's a 9, so 7 and 8, he does it, 9, they give him a Sinclair computer. Your poor parents, were they scientists? No, my father works in a construction and my mother is a nurse, but they separated when I was 9 and later divorced. I shouldn't say. Doesn't that make sense? This boy would do the math. I had learning difficulties and was in a remedial class at school. I wasn't interested in what the teachers were doing. I taught myself maths and relativity when I was 7. Okay, well, he claims he has. It'd be nice to see if... I just can't... I'm determined to answer the question of how now, because I was told I wasn't any good. What are you doing to pursue those childhood dreams? There are four missions in my lab. To build a robot that can do all of chemistry and digitize it, we call it a computer. To create artificial life, to understand information and make the chemical brain. They're effectively about the same thing, understanding the interaction of information and chemistry. Let's see. To build a robot that can do all chemistry. Okay. What does information in chemistry mean? It's another way of asking how chemical systems can process information beyond information storage or logical operations or molecular electronics. It's asking how biological cells process information and what the physical principles are that allow this to happen. 50 people employed to this person. Okay. And this can help your ambition of creating artificial life? The information as a concept refers to data about reality that's encoded and needs encoded. So I think that information only exists if it is biology. Not everyone agrees with this approach. But if we create a new chemical systems that process information, perhaps that can be viewed as a new type of life form. Making a new type of life form is a vital endeavor if we are to start to understand the missing physics in biology and chemistry and the missing rules of the universe that allowed the emergence of life in the first place. Alright, I'm just reading it. Don't blame me, mate. Life is a slippery thing to define. Here's an idea. Let's think of living things as machines that can produce complex objects and do not have that could not have randomly formed. From DNA to iPhones, they require information to assemble them. By thinking about life in this way, we can design a way to measure whether something is alive and then use that to make a machine to discover the route to life. Look at his face. If you crossed him, he would just absolutely rip your heart out. But you know, I'm gonna hold judgment off on this chap. I don't actually understand what this is. This Lee Cronin's program of a molecule maker. We want to build a robot that can do all chemistry, quote. I want to do for chemistry what the Large Hadron Collider has done for physics. They had a theory that predicted the existence of the Higgs boson and developed a model to find what energy range to look in, then built the LHC to look for it. We're developing a new origin of life theory and a model so we can work out what time is required, what resources are needed, and what scale of machines need to find the right route to the new life form. This sort of thing means that, you know, myself, say I've come up with legitimate maths, I haven't got a hope. It's like, oh God. How far have you got? In my lab, I'm creating a physical model of the world in which you have simple rocks and simple organic molecules and develop a way of getting from there to genetics. I want to understand what's the differences between the stuff that is just complicated to make, such as the arrangement of molecules, and the stuff that requires information to make, such as basic cellular machinery. We're looking for molecules that have a high molecular weight, that are abundant and require more information to make them just a random mess. If we start to see such molecules forming, what does it mean? It can't be alive according to the standard definition of life. And it's happening through random chemistry, but if it's selected molecules direct the creation of the next, increasing complex models, isn't that like life? So, I don't have proof that this can happen yet, but my guess is that all matter wants to be Darwinian, and we'll get the selfish molecule that will try to convert all our molecules to be like it. This is taking my breath away. How can you? You really need, it says, New Scientist Life. Here, Lee Cronin speak about chemical brains and creating artificial life in New Scientist Life, September 2023. Okay. That's why he's going to be going soon. You say you want to make a chemical brain too. Why? Your brain is made of molecules and you can think. So is a rock, so is a piece of poo, mate. What is it about your brain that allows you to do this? Instead of trying to imagine your brain, to find out, trying to image a brain to find out, why don't we just make one? There are 100 billion neurons in each brain, each with 1,000 connections. Overall, there's more potential configurations of neurons and their connections in your brain than there are atoms in the universe. That's why consciousness will never be realized in silicon computers, and why Elon Musk is foolish. Oh, way. Poor Elon Musk. He's got even complete people against him. I just think Elon Musk is a pretty amazing person. He's just the right person. He keeps on going on about strong AI machines that can think like humans. We'll have improved AI, but silicon doesn't allow enough available states to do anything. Get really interesting. We need to create chemical brains to understand consciousness. What about quantum computing? This is so sad. What about Google DeepMind? They're doing some amazing stuff. His stuff, obviously, is going to be better than Google Mine. Just give me a few million dollars and I'll just ramp it on talk. DeepMind is brilliant. But I doubt they're ever going to understand what human intelligence really is unless they go beyond silicon-based computers. God, they are able to mimic some aspects, but ultimately I think it's more like a very good simulation tailored for specific jobs. I don't think it's even possible to simulate the brain on a computer because we are missing so many rules. The substrate is not complex enough. I want to make a chemical brain, not to beat mind, but to uncover the missing science and perhaps make a different types of non-biological inorganic intelligence. You know what? I'm going to poo-poo this, and this is going to be the next big thing next year. This will be the biggest thing ever, and it's about time for me just to give up. How would you go about making a chemical brain? We're trying to see how a physical neural network rather than an electronic circuit can be used physically to compute the process of information within a polymer so we can make a physical chemical wet brain. We use a gel of conducting fibers on top of an electrode array. We tickle the bottom with random electrical inputs and give the outputs to webcam. Show it human faces and see if we can train the gel to recognize them. When we've got a brain gel that we've trained for one problem, we'll see if we can solve others with it. Do you think this effect could affect how we see consciousness? If we make a brain in the lab and show that we can generate self-awareness in a certain chemical environment, that might change our view on consciousness. Take the chemical environment inside a jellyfish. They might be conscious at a basic level, or at least aware of their environment, but it's a different way to whatever we imagine consciousness to be. If that's consciousness, and free will really exists, I have my doubts. Okay, what's up with your gut? I mean, this is getting pretty low quality stuff. Okay, what's up with your guts? And of course, these people, when you actually say, if you're a reader, say if your reader is above the level of these journalists, they will shut you down. Okay. So what's up with your guts? Forget gluten. There's a more surprising culprit behind your digestive problems, says Chloe Lambert. South Beach, paleo, vegan, juice cleanse, and FODMAPs, short for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, polyrols. The name FODMAP certainly doesn't have an instant appeal, but a diet focused on avoiding these substances is catching on with the public and the medical professions alike. These low FODMAP diets are based not on celebrities' waistlines or detox bunkum, but on the premise that a healthy gut leads to a happy life. So popular is it proving that there are now claims that the diet could alleviate everything from digestion to chronic fatigue. Over the past few years, we've become much more clued in about the extensive influence of gut health and disease. The impact of lifestyle choices can have on what some researchers call our second brain, which is true, yeah, that a lot of neurons and, like, it's almost a brain is associated with the gut. Gluten, a protein found comes from the word glue, amazingly. I think I'll research what gluten is, but I'll have a new go what gluten is. In grains such as wheat, barley and rye, has taken much of the blame, with a growing number of people claiming that they have some sort of gluten intolerance. Global sales for gluten-free food rose 12.6% in 2016, and specialist supermarket sales are now heave with gluten-free products, even though the idea that people can be gluten-sensitive even if they don't have an autoimmune disorder like colic disease has largely been debunked. I think that's a real story, how stupid people can be. Now, the gut health tide is turning. Once again, it appears that gut problems linked to certain foods like bread might reveal for many. What's more, the secret to dealing with these problems could fly in the face of established healthy eating advice. The most common cause of gut problems is irritable bowel syndrome, a catch-all term for poorly understood constellation. I love this constellation of symptoms, including bloating, diarrhea, constipation, or feeling ill at the same time. It affects millions, although it doesn't appear to be on the rise. With the incidence in the West between 5 and 15% of the population. What? What? That's more than 1 in 10 people have irritable bowel. However, if it feels like you can't go to a dinner party without someone talking about their gut problems, that might be down to a shift in awareness. Quote, people are noticing symptoms more and reporting them, said Peter Gobson of Monash University in Melbourne. Quote, 6 years ago we had no criteria to diagnose irritable bowel syndrome, and people with gut problems just put up with it. IBS symptoms overlap with colic disease. From colics, consuming gluten causes symptoms such as diarrhea, constipation, cramp and fatigue, and triggers a faulty immune reaction that damages the lining of the gut. Although unrelated to IBS in origin, colic disease has been attracting attention because of its proving to be more common than previously thought, affecting 1% of the people. However, many who test negative to it, showing no signs of antibodies with response to gluten or gut damage, still complain about wheat products make them feel unwell. It's like a nocebo stuff, isn't it? This has been labelled as non-coliac gluten sensitivity, although the condition remains controversial, like it's a load of rot. Some argue that gluten poorly digested by many people, that ubiquity in modern processed foods is all with the diet what human guts have all to deal with. Quote, wheat is a friend that's outstayed its welcome for some of us, says David Sanders, University of Sheffield, UK. Skepticism over whether gluten can cause symptoms on non-coliacs has been fueled by the fact that cutting it out has become fashionable lifestyle choice studies. Show that many non-coliacs are choosing to avoid gluten because they believe doing so is healthy despite little evidence of its benefits. Yeah, the ability of people to make lifestyle choices is pretty amazing. Okay, in one study, 22,000 adults in the US and the proportion eating gluten-free diet more than tripled from 0.75% to 1.69%. In 2013, although a proportion had colic disease stayed roughly constant. Also, in 2013, 30% of adults in the US reported trying to cut down gluten. The gluten-free craze is marketed as a dream. It's perfectly worry-well scenario, says Kevin Whelan of King's College London. We're seeing people avoiding it in the belief will help them lose weight and it will improve their overall health. But beyond celiac disease, gluten's role in optimizing health is nowhere near what people think it is. Even gluten itself is not the culprit. We are not now understanding why so many people believe they are sensitive to it. A growing variety of evidence of the past few years points to the finger at FODMAPs. These carbohydrates are present in numerous foods, including wheat, which contains something called fructans. If you go a gluten-free diet, you reduce the probability of your 50% of your food maps, said Gibson. Rather than having some sort of sensitivity to gluten, it seems that some people with IBS, FODMAPs could be the trigger. Oh, this is almost irresponsible. Okay. That was illustrated by recent trials in 59 non-celiac adults on a gluten-free diet. We fed identical tasting cereal bars packed with either gluten, fructans, or neither. Those who had fructan bars 15% more bloating and 13% more overall gut symptoms compared with those of the control group, which those who had gluten bar felt no worse afterwards. Like many studies that show that fructans were the signals, if gluten causes IBS, it's nowhere near as frequent as people says, Gibson says, upon our research in cereal, as well as being present in wheat and grains, FODMAPs. Just for this agonizing thing, we go out to pizza, not very often. And of course, we've got these special people, can I have a pizza, a gluten-free pizza, please? No mushrooms, because I don't want to eat any funguses. No onions. Besides, they just, I don't know what they do. MRI studies show that when digested, these compounds increase the production of gas and the volume of water in the bowel, causing distension. That doesn't cause an issue for most people, but for up to 70% of people with IBS, reducing the intake of these foods provides relief from the pain of bloating. Low FODMAP diet is considered to be effective for IBS, is now recommended by the National Health Service in the UK and bodies including the Gastroenterological Society of Australia. The type and quantity of FODMAPs that trigger symptoms varies enormously between individuals, but Gibson says that the worst offenders are those onion, garlic, wheat, rye, and barley. The variability means that anyone embarking on a low FODMAP diet should seek help from a trained professional rather than relying on internet articles, although health authorities are still struggling to train enough people to meet the demands, says Gibson. As the buzz around low FODMAP diets spreads, it's attracting attention for its potential in other gastrointestinal conditions, including acid reflux and digestion. The diet is now being recommended in the management of inflammatory bowel diseases, IBDS, such as Crohn's conditions, that are becoming more frequent in the West, possibly because of the smoking and additives in the food we eat. IBS-like symptoms are very common in the people IBD. You wouldn't put them in the low FODMAP diet if they've got a very active inflammation, but it's a well-controlled, it's very effective. After research, I noticed that people with IBS felt more tired when they ate lots of FODMAPs and less so on low FODMAP diets. There has been hope that it might help people with the chronic fatigue syndromes who have high incidences of IBS. But Gibson says the evidence so far this is weak, and the diet's effect on fatigue only happens among people with IBS. Although it's appealing to think that we might all benefit from fewer FODMAPs, in our life, if you don't have a bowel problem, there's absolutely no rationale for being on a low FODMAPs diet, says Gibson. This is not a diet for good health. One drawback on the diet is it cuts out food that are important sources of vitamins, fiber, and nutrients such as calcium. Recently, there's been serious concerns that it depresses the level of good bacteria in the gut, and even long-term consequences of the diet remain unclear. Many people trying to avoid FODMAPs struggle to work out which food to eliminate. Quote, it's helped an awful lot of people, says Peter Wallwell, a gastroenterologist at the University of Manchester, UK, but one patient will it will be tomatoes, and others it will be lettuce, and others none of the above. Can you imagine you cut out lettuce? Intriguingly, a third of people with RBS who tried a diet reaped no benefit at all. For them, some researchers are now looking at more controversial alternatives. When it comes to gut health, one of the most common pieces of advice is to eat plenty of fibre, such as whole grain bread and fibrous vegetables, which keep the gut working properly and can reduce the risk of cancer, cardiovascular disease. But it now seems that fibre may also be part of the problem. Some types of fibre release gas when fermented in the bowel, causing irritation of sensitive individuals. Whirlwell was one of the first to demonstrate that reducing fibre could be beneficial for IBS, with the study finding that wheat bran made 55% of people with IBS feel worse and only 10% feel better. The idea was gaining ground, although it has been lately overshadowed by the fuss over FODMAPs. Whirlwell often advises patients to try switching from whole grain to white bread. Fibre is just as important as FODMAPs in aggravating irritable bowel, he says. Whirlwell even speculates the push for healthier diets, the higher fibre and fruit vegetables may be contributing to the rise of gut complaints. 30 years ago, nobody had heard of fibre a day, he said. It amazes me how many vegetables people are eating these days. The trouble with advising patients to eliminate both FODMAPs and fibre diets in the face of good nutrition. In future, IBS treatment will probably be involved supplements containing combinations of beneficial slow fermented fibres, says Whelan, who's studying the fibre effects on the guts. And though gastroenterologists remain divided over the issue of gluten, some believe it may yet prove to be have adverse effects beyond colic disease. Quote, the research evidence is nowhere near catching up with the marketing machine, says Whelan. But I think non-coliac gluten sensitivity exists. Some people, when given gluten challenge, do get symptoms, although identifying who they are and how they differ from people actually responding to functions is difficult. The good news for those with gut problems is the diversity of symptoms and causes are being investigated like never before. For those who don't, however, it might be time to step off the bandwagon, says Saunders. If you don't have any symptoms, you don't need to be in any diets.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.